Another aspect of the writing was a one-time shot and something I'd like to get back into, and that is Bible study fiction writing. I've only done one so far. I've got four planned, but I don't think my life will last that long to accomplish the other three. But the one I did was Too Many Doors. It was written for camp originally. It was not used because some of the language was considered a little too coarse for our children, and I felt that the person who was speaking the words that I spoke, it wouldn't be true without those words. But I was trying to present in the book the dilemma of a person seeking CO, that the answers are not simple. And I presented some of the challenges that we don't usually hear. And I didn't give the answers. The object of the book was not to give the answers. I also presented a secondary theme of the book, which was the romance of a Bible student with a non-Bible student, and the conflict in his mind, his interests, especially since the one in the book is a non-consecrated, and the problems that he faced, and problems he faced with the truth itself. Even though the camp didn't want to use it, Sister Linda Larson encouraged me. She distributed it for me, printed 500 copies, and they went fast. I think they may reprint this year. Other books I've been involved in have been printed have been so far not new authorships of mine. The Songs of the Nightingale was a poetry book. Sister in Canada, they collected these poems. Sister from Labrador, over on the east coast of Canada. And they wound up in the hands of Sister Betty O'Toole, where Margaret Ferguson inherited them. She persuaded me to get them published. Sister Shirley Evans did the design work and published that. And now Shirley's working on another book that's in its final stages called Sparkling Books and Gentle Breezes, about different stories that, little anecdotes that have a spiritual meaning, plus a lot of one-liners. And this brings us to the writing experience that happened since I became paralyzed. This goes back on the foreign travels. Sometimes language can be a problem in foreign travels, and I found this great difficulty in Poland on one occasion. We were visiting the brethren in Bielogard in the north of Poland, and we were to go from there to visit the retirement center in the south of Poland. The brethren in Bielogard, very few of them speak any English, and those that do are very minimal, and my Polish is about equally strong as their English is. My brother Dmitry Kopak asked me, he said, "Will you go down? We've heard there are problems with the building of the retirement center. I'd like to hear what those problems are and how they're progressing." So I got to Krakow, and Brother Kowacz with me, took me to the center, and I asked him through translators the question, "What are the problems?" And he said, "Well, we have to have problems." He said, "In order to build, we needed to get official permission from the government, and we couldn't get the papers." But he said, "Now it's okay. Now we got the papers." So I went back up to North Poland, and Brother Kopak asked me, "What's the situation?" "I'll try to give it to you in two languages." And I said, "Oh, Bacie Maduja Popane. My brother had some great problems. Bacie Pucie Buja Papiersz. Bacie Nima Papiersz. Brother don't have the papers. Abo Teles is up here. Now it's better. Teles Bacie Ma Papiersz." And he looked at me and said, "What are you saying?" And what I was saying in my mind was they got papers. I didn't know that Papier is paper and Papier is just the Pope. And I was saying they need the Pope, and now they got the Pope, so better. Another experience in foreign travels that was a little bit of a problem was on our first trip to Egypt. We were told very carefully to enter the country, no pictures to be taken of any military establishments. And I told the group that. So you go out to see the pyramids at Memphis. And while we're going through the pyramids, Chris Larson, studying geography, was up on a hill to take pictures of the Nile Delta, not knowing it's a military base. He's arrested at the top of this hill. And the guard comes over and said, "They arrested one of your men." So I went over there in a little hut in the desert. A bunch of desert urchins around, walking around, playing. I walk in, and Chris is sitting here. His camera's on the desk. The guards are over there. So they go for his camera. So they go for it, Chris goes for it. They back off, Chris backs off. And they play this game 5-10 times, going for the camera. Chris said, "I got pictures of the Great Pyramid. I don't want to lose in that camera." And so finally, my guide comes in, he interprets. And Chris had asked him, "Do you speak English?" And one of the little boys outside said, "I speak English." And the guard quickly sent those boys away. They didn't want them near. So the guard came in, and he said, "Well, you got problems. You're going to have to go downtown to the courts instead of us, because they want to arrest you." So we let the group go, and I said, we'll meet you at the hotel. And Chris and I went down to the center location, the police headquarters. And that's where they had the police jail there, too. And walked in, and the guard was with us, and also the guy arrested us. And they said, well, you're going to need to see the captain. Fine, where's the captain? Well, he's up for siesta. He'll be back at 2 o'clock, about 12:45. You can sit in the brig there in the meantime. So we didn't need to go into the jail. We sat by it. 2.5 hot hours later, in comes the guard, spit and polish, beautifully gentleman. Welcome the perfect English to his room. He said, gentlemen, what can I do for you? So we tell him the story that we're tourists, and we didn't know this was a guard. And so let me talk to the arresting officer. And I talked back and forth, very animated and Egyptian. And he said, well, I can't release you without permission from the general. So he said, I'll call the general, find out what he says. So he called the general, talked to the general in Egyptian. He said, I told the general you're a tourist. Take any pictures you want. And Chris said, great, can I have your picture? Oh, no. You can't have my picture. He said, I have a brother in New York. You can give him a message for me. Well, earlier that day, at another experience, I'd gone to the Cairo Museum to get permission from Marge to go and photograph the pit for the pyramid. And the bureaucracy was such you went from door to door to door to door. Couldn't get any worse. Finally, I found the right guy. He was the minister of the pyramid itself. And very polite gentleman. I said, sure, certainly, so that's very fine. I'll take your wife there personally this afternoon, give her a tour there, pick up some other sites around that you might like to see. I said, that's very good. So I thanked him. He was to meet us at 3 o'clock, whatever time it was, at the hotel. So I go outside of the office into the museum. All the doors are locked. I'm locked in with all the mummies. That's the closing time. I finally find one door that's open. I get out that door. And this is right during the Israeli-Egyptian conflicts. And they got sandbags all around the hotel. It's all sandbagged up. And armed soldiers and gunmen all around there. So I walk out, and all the gates on the outside are locked. And just then I notice the captain come in, the guard. The outsourcing command, they all jump to order, and they stand in line and start marching out. And I can figure out they're changing the guard. So in the back row, there's one empty spot. So I went in and marched with them. So if I can get out this way, maybe. And the guy next to me starts talking to me in Arabic. I think Arabic, maybe Russian. So I just heard one word, Ruski. And I thought he was asking me, you're a Russian advisor, aren't you? And I said, no, I'm an American. Oh, good, my brother's in Los Angeles. And then the captain looked around, he saw what was happening. He laughed. He said, come on, no problem getting out of there. We get back to the States. The year before, I had a problem with the pants flying down. Now this. We got a party showing pictures at the Nowinski home. And Billy Newell comes. And he brings me a nice belt buckle. It's protected by the Egyptian army. Okay, let's go to another area. I don't know when this part of my life began. It probably began in the mid-80s. Athena was playing and threw a yardstick down the steps, and I didn't notice it. I came home from work. I had back the butt of my arm. I was going down. Here's a yardstick going, kerplop, right on my back on the stairs. And I got up, and I couldn't move my arm at all. His arm was just real limp. Went to a chiropractor, and about 2 months later, it was stretching it and everything. It was just fine. It's fine now today. Well, now I want to shift forward to 1989. I was at the meeting, and I started having a real bad coughing spell, and I couldn't stop coughing. And so I went out in the outer lobby and coughed for about 20 minutes. Finally got through it. Went home, and I was just beat, tuckered out. I told my wife, I need a whirlpool. So she ran the water, and I wish she wouldn't run water for me because she wasn't going to do hot. I should run it myself, but I was tired, and I had to run the water. And I stepped in and said, oh, this stem is cool. That's unusual for the wife to say. Put my other foot on, yikes! Water was hot. I had no temperature sensation in the right leg. So then I got get out of the tub. The left leg was very weak. I started buckling on every time. But so I went to see the doctor, and he called it the Brown-Séquard syndrome, where these two legs operate differently. And he said, it's usually a sign of MS. And so I said, you probably have MS. And so they kept me for a barrage of tests, and they took a myelogram, and they sent it to Rochester for analysis. And I came back, no MS, fine. They said, well, you'd be fine with me. I don't know what your problem is. He said, I would advise you to go down to the Chicago Neurological Clinic, which is the best experts we have in Chicago on nerves, and see what they say. So I went down, I saw Dr. Brown there. It wasn't Dr. Brown, another doctor there. And he said, well, I think your problem is that you got a spur on the spine that's touching the spinal column. And to relieve that, we're going to have to go in and operate and remove three of the lamina of those backbone braces and cut that spur off to get there. He said, that hopefully they'll do it. He said, it's a rather serious operation, so you may want to think about it. And I said, well, what I need to do, I need to do. I said, call my cardiologist and be sure he okays it. And he called my cardiologist and said, I think that's far too dangerous. I don't recommend you do it. So he called the operation off one day before. And he sent me to Dr. Brown. Dr. Brown looked me over and he said, no, it is not a spinal spur. I think what you have is a spur, especially on the blood column. And he said, it's not going to be harm. When harm is done, it's done, it's done. I can't correct that. He said, it won't do any more harm. So I said, live with it. Living with it meant falling every once a day or twice a day sometimes, especially the hard work because you get the snow pile, I fall in the snow pile harder than getting up. I kept going. It wasn't too badly. And that was in February of 1990. By the time I went to Poitiers, I said, I had real problems. I was falling over the place. I fell on the boat in Helsinki. I fell twice during the meeting at Cluj, Romania. I fell on the train once. I was having a hard time holding my balance. But, I was surviving. I got by. And, oh, this is worth life. It's not that bad. Then in November of 1991, we had a birthday party for Joanna. And it was cold outside, but I wanted to sleep outside because it was so hot inside. November, I should have done that. I was in shivers out there. I came back in. I went to bed downstairs. Woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And I had all the symptoms of a heart attack. I was having palpitations, I was having shooting pains down the arm, perspiring, heavy pressure on the chest. And so Marge came out and gave me about a half hour rub. And I said, that's not helping it. You better call 911. I said, call 911 and let's take it into Good Samaritan Hospital. Against my will, I didn't go to the Edward Hospital, but they took me to Good Samaritan. And they sent me out in the emergency room, the EKG, and I was fine. There was nothing wrong with the heart. There was no heart attack. And they said, but you are in danger of a stroke. You need to be on a blood thinner. And we'll put you on heparin here, and then you'll go home in 2 minutes. So I put my heparin that night, and I woke up early in the morning, and I need to go to the bathroom. And I felt a little weak going to the bathroom, but not that bad. And then I woke up a couple hours later, and I need to go to the bathroom again. And this time, the leg was trying to buckle under me. And I forget if it was 3 times or not. I finally called the nurse in. I said, I need a doctor. I said, there's something wrong. I'm not able to stand. And I said, there's no doctor on duty tonight. Can't see you tonight. And I said, argue, but I didn't argue. I slept, woke up in the morning. Both legs were very weak. I couldn't stand at all. So I called the nurse in and said, I do need a doctor. I said, well, I'll get one in as soon as possible, maybe afternoon. About 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the doctor finally came in. By that time, I was gone. I had no balance, no nothing. And the cardiologist came in, and very nice cardiologist. I said, I want to go to Rochester. I want to get experts on this. I told him, I'd like to see here. And the cardiologist said, you go to Rochester? You'll go, but you'll be a corpse when you get there. You won't make it. Let's take a medevac plane. You need serious medical help tonight. So he said, you don't need it here. You need it in the teaching hospital. I recommend Loyola. I said, no, I don't want Loyola. Okay, then I recommend Northwestern. So I sent downtown, and they did a X-ray on the spine, spinal myelogram, it was called. In any case, I didn't take the anesthesia well at all. And I didn't come out of it. I couldn't breathe. As long as they had the tubes on me, the breathing apparatus, I could breathe. Take it out, I just stopped breathing. I know Tom Ruggiero came in, along with George Tabak, to see me. And I told Tom, I said, Tom, please take my funeral. And I was sure that was the end. And I really wanted to get out of there because I had a wedding to do that weekend, Danny Carriga. So I said, Tom, take the wedding, which he did. But for the next week, I was so out of it. It's a brief memory. It's really gone. And then all of a sudden, my strength came back, and I wanted to get back to work. I went to rehabilitation, and I had to get out of there early because the heart was in bad shape at the time. I had 70% blockage at the main artery. So they had to solve that before they could do any more. So I had three difficult times there. It was no touch and go for a while. And I was surprised at myself. I was never depressed. I expected to be. But just somehow, I said, okay, this is interesting. What's going to happen next? And this was right at the time that Tanya Harding was hurt, the skater. And her second statement really got to me. She said, when it first happened, why me? And then 2 seconds later, oh, why not me? And I said the same. I said, why not me? The other encouragement I had was Terry Anderson, who just released from the Lebanese prisons. And he was so upbeat from his experience. I thought, he can be that upbeat, I can be upbeat. And maybe I can be an example to others. So I decided to make it. But I didn't do too well for a while there. I was having problems. And that one of the biggest problems was deciding what to do with my life. What should I do? They wanted me to get back to work. Because that's the idea of rehab. Rehab is to rehabilitate you, put you back in the workforce. Well, I knew if I went back to work, that not only would it require great effort on my part, but the office had spent thousands of dollars remodeling the office. We did not have a wheelchair accessible office. We were against all the codes. And I didn't want to do that to them. So I was debating which way to go. I was not financially in a position to retire. I had quite a small amount of funds, not enough to last me over 5-6 months at the most, and I would be totally broke. So I didn't know whether we could retire, what to do, look at different options. Finally, Marge brought in the mail just before Christmas, big stack of mail. And I said, let's talk about this. We talked about it. I said, well, there comes a time to step out in faith. Let's step out. I'm going to retire. We'll see what happens. I knew that worst comes to worst. I had a safety net under me that could kind of play. So, fine. She agreed. Hand me the mail. First letter opened up, anonymous, a check for $2,000. It's like the Lord had said, I approve your decision. And it was amazing. I had another check about 2 months later, another $2,000, same person, I guess, anonymous also. I don't know who sent me all this money. I have a good idea. But then the person never came forward. Roger Adams came in, said, we'll build the room on for you. I'm out of the room, virtually no cost. George Tadak designed the addition to the house. Everybody was kicking in, doing this and doing that. I said, well, this isn't working. It has worked. I had to wait 6 months before Medicare would kick in. So 6 months I had to live on the edge. I had Blue Cross, but that was under COBRA, and that was not a good plan. When Blue Cross kicked in, my bank balance was exactly the same as it had been 6 months before. It had changed a bit. Within $5-$10, it went out. And we squeezed by, and the Lord has given us what we needed. I found that all through my life. I remember one of the things that we liked to do when we had the ability was we liked to advance by loan, no interest loan, to those who live here, the tuition for college. And sometimes you wondered if the money would be there to pay for it. You just weren't sure. You knew yet, you may have to dig in hard to find it. And I remember once had a need for a loan, and I didn't have the money. And I thought, where am I going to get it? $1,500. And I thought, Lord, you know, I'm going to take a loan myself to get this one, probably. Went to the Detroit convention that weekend, and Renata Wagner was there. And she came and said, here's the last of what I owe you, Dad. And she gave me a check, $1,500. The exact amount. It was just as though, you need it, here it is. It turns around, and it works out very well. So I've been blessed with the policy now all these years, and never charging them a board, and we're glad we didn't. Because it's just, that's what we should do. We're living that way. Treat what we have as the Lord's goods and to treat it that way. But now I was paralyzed. And now I had no job. I tied my hand, nothing to do with it. Got a letter in the mail from Tim Thomason. And the letter was sort of a group letter. It was written to me alone, I could tell that. It was written to several other people. And it was the Herald was looking for editors to work on the Herald editorial board. But by this time, I was very dissatisfied with the Herald. They'd been under a management that I thoroughly disagreed with. I appreciate my people as Christians, but not their teachings. And so I had no desire to be involved. So I took the letter and threw it in the garbage can as soon as I got it. Then in the morning, I woke up, got out of bed, and I said, that really was not the right thing to do. I should at least take it to the Lord in prayer before we throw it away. So I took it out. I took it to the Lord in prayer. And I meditated about it for a few, 4 days. And finally I decided, well, I don't want the job, but I don't want to just say no. So I did with the same equivalent of saying no. I said to him, yeah, I'll take it for 1 year on the following conditions. That the Herald would go back to the teaching of Brother Russell. And then that's what the founders wanted. Well, I knew the majority of the directors did not believe that. So I said, I'm safe. I get a letter back saying, would you also be managing editor? And I wrote back a letter and I said, no, I had another condition. I want complete veto power. What goes in? If I think an article is out of harmony with that, I would not use the article. And they went by it under those circumstances. And I got a letter back and said, we're having a meeting at Richmond, Virginia Convention. We'd like to talk to you. So I went to the meeting, and I'm very warmly familiar. I'm saying your dad, I'm talking to Tom Hack. Bruno Hack set a pattern for me early in my life to the Herald that I greatly appreciated. He was the one that introduced me to the Herald in Chicago. And Bruno was the one that got me involved with the Herald originally because of Brother Fry. Brother Fry was one of the speakers, and that was one of Bruno's favorite speakers. So when the Herald had a convention, your dad would always take me. We'd go down. So I knew the brother pretty well. I knew the cooperation they'd given us on the reprints. So these are brothers I knew I was comfortable with, but I did not agree with. And I was not about to shake my beliefs or edit something I couldn't agree with. The meeting was very cordial. Immediately they said yes. Then they said, now, what's the possibility of presenting both sides? Having honest dialogue and things like the presence. And I said, I've got no problem with dialogue on the presence or any subject, but not in a Herald magazine. My dialogue has got to be in a separate medium. The directors plainly said that they chose the name Herald because of the belief in the presence of Christ in his kingdom. So I said, I'm not willing to do that. And after the discussion for about an hour, I said, if you'll take the job, we'll appreciate it. So I took the job, and at first, before I took it, I asked the Chicago elders what they thought. And there was 9 elders at the time, and it was 8-1 against it. I was the only elder who said yes, that I should take it, and I was really abstaining. So it was really 8-0. So I asked the elders, I said, do you mean by this I should not take it, or do you mean by this that your advice is that I did not take it? And they said the latter. It's your conscience. You do what you want. So I said, well, I'm going to take one more step. I'll bring it to the class. And I brought it to the class, and there was very mixed emotion. Some were very strong against it. One is to this day. But most of them were moderate. And I said, yeah, I'll do it. I want to go at risk in a year. I can back out if it doesn't work. It worked so well. It served a need for me. It's given me something to do in my retirement years, something I can do with the computer, and it's a certain need for them. They seem to be generally happy with the direction it's going. Those who did not agree the Lord is present, and many dropped out. There are two that are left. The one that will drop out this year, I know, and one may drop out shortly. But they're very cooperative. There's no problem with it. And my biggest problem was, again, getting my old buddy Mike in the Corps involved. Because I knew if I'm going to make this thing go forward, I need Michael's skills. And Michael was very reticent. And he came to me at St. Joseph Convention, and he said, if you want, I'll be an editor. And I said, I want. Next year he said, you want, I'll be a director. And he got on as director and editor both. So it's been a very good experience. One of the blessings on the sideline of this has been that in 1994, I believe it was, we published a special issue of the Herald, giving the history of the Bible Student Movement. And it was an abbreviated book. It was not abbreviated, it was 32 pages, just like the Herald is. And it covered history of the whole gospel age, but focusing down on the Bible Center where we come from, Ministry of Brother Russell. 2 years ago, the trustees voted that we were out of these copies, do a new one, expanded. And that just finished now. We're just now in the final editing stages. Michael just wrote me yesterday that he's got the entire thing put together. I think it's going to be a very good issue. It goes into the divisions from Brother Russell's day. It goes into hot areas. But it gives a perspective on the Bible Study Movement that I think very few have seen. And Jeff has designed a fantastic cover for it. The talk he gave at the symposium to even Chicago, he rewrote that into an article for the Herald for this issue. And I think that was an outstanding issue. But it's got very good articles. Another move was the thematic issues. We did the themes. Also, we've done the idea of being a broker for other publications. Instead of representing the Herald will advertise the best booklet in the area. It was a Dawn booklet, Chicago booklet, whatever it is. That's the book that will be advertised. We are presently distributors of the Cedars Works. They distributed the Iverson Library CD-ROMs. They distributed the Sons of Nightingale. And now we're taking out a project coming up very shortly to distribute a group of children's books that are being paid for by the Brethren of Australia. And the Herald become the distributor of that. So that's been a great activity. That brings me to the last year of my life. This last year has been an exciting year. One thing I've done over the years is try to recognize my own shortcomings, things where I'm not good at. And one of the things I recognized years ago, I'm not an organizer. I'm an idea man, but I'm not one to carry out. I'm not a detail person. I need my Michael, or somebody like Michael, to do the detail work. So I've always steadily declined all chairmanships of any committee. I said, no, I'm not a chairman. That is not my, I'm a worker. I work on a committee, but I'll not be chairman. Last election, we were on the way to the meeting, and I got some bad symptoms, went to the hospital for emergency room, skipped the elections, and I was voted chairman of the witness activity committee. And I said, of all committees, that's the last committee I want to be chairman of. In fact, I don't even want to be on that committee. Because that committee, I've been on so many times, and there's so much talk and so little work. I said, no, we're not getting it done. So we tried something this past year. So I thought my fellow committee members were Mark Candle and Jeff Mesra. I thought, well, this could be an interesting year. I know how these brethren feel. They're all proactive. Their brethren want to do things. I'll give it a try. I've never been a chairman before, but we'll try a scheme. I think it may work. And that was to hold monthly meetings of the committee. And to every meeting, go over everything we have in the works that's being done and that which is being planned to be done and see how the class takes to it. The class has been much more supportive than I expected. Everything that we asked for, they give us a green light. We've done 31 projects during the year. We've done over 5,000 responses. And probably the most daring one, which we learned a lot of lessons. We didn't do it right, but we learned it was still done well, was a public talk where it was God and 9/11. We spent a lot of money for a fancy hall for 16 people. Not worth it. We spent a lot of money for television advertising. As far as we know, no footage from that. There may have been some. But what we did right was the internet. Jordan Gray's work on getting on the internet for us and working with us so that the cost per listener was far less than we'd ever done. It's $5.49 a listener. Over 2,900 listeners. In fact, now it's over 3,000. They're still listening to it. It's still being, that was good. Magazine advertising worked well. Probably the biggest surprise to me was the homeschool mailing. I was not for it. I voted for it. I said, we've got to try it. But when we raised $1,800, we will probably get 50 responses, and that'd be fine. We got close to 500 responses. It was very, very reasonable. Erwin Kaliska's idea that he presented 2 years ago of having a monthly ad in the Sun-Times, extremely well. And working with Mark and Jeff has been a great experience. We had not always agreed. We had different opinions. But we worked together and worked it out. And I'm very happy. I don't know if the class is going to be happy when they see the fact we spent $40,000 of their money. But maybe they'll be happy when they see the 5,000 responses that money produced. So we'll see. But that's been the latest. Now I can look forward to new challenges. I have still got things I want to write. Still got things I want to be active in. Not quite ready to lay back yet and just die. Die standing up. Well, I can't do that. Die sitting, winning around. Barely we roll along. It's been a great life. Well worth living. I was really just asking what my other novels were. The first novel, which is spoken orally but never written, was called Almost a Sabra. And it was followed the life of a young Jewish girl from the early 1900s. In Russia, in the pogroms, her trip to Israel, her experiences during the Nazi persecution, her marriage to a Jewish fighter pilot, her disappointment over the accolades that he received, and her conversion toward a peaceful acceptance of Israel. That was a novel, I think, about 32 chapters. When we did a successive nights, as I told the story to you. Another one I'd just begun was on the Ten Commandments. And this one is the life of a very successful high school basketball player, traces him through college and in his pro years, and shows how one by one he's challenged and meeting the Ten Commandments and how these commandments affect the real life. And the third one, which is untitled, is one I was very excited about. I did actually get some of it down on paper. It's a novel of the Underground Railroad. And it traces a family, a white family who helped the Underground Railroad. How he becomes a Baptist minister afterwards. How he becomes meeting the Bible students. How he becomes converted to the Bible student preaching. Becomes an elder and a pilgrim under Brother Russell. And it's fixing ideals of Brother Russell's there. Those are the four novels I've got in life. My secular work began in Iowa in between my junior and senior years of high school. The editor of the local paper, sister had been in charge of all the news, and she got TV and put in a sanitarium. And he was looking for somebody to fill in. And first my job was to just melt down the lead and do the dirty work and learn how to set type and do this. But gradually he trained me into writing the stories, and then he needed a photographer. And he made a deal with the school that anything that happened during the school year, a call to the school would bring me out of class, and I could go and cover the story for the paper. I remember one accident that happened, and I was such a rush to get there. I took his car and I spun around in triple circles before I went on the gravel road. It went a little too fast. But he was very forgiving with the accidents I had with his car, and he is one of my best friends to this day. Every time I go to Iowa City, I mean, 91 years old now. A real pioneer in the local papers. Very fine man. Well, then when I left the Alcator, I went to the Dawn, and of course there again, it was in a printing plant. When I began to realize I may want to work in New York, I thought I'd get a job as they called Ludlow Setter. That's where they set type in individual papers. I learned how to do case setting and type. But I wasn't fast enough. I passed the test. And then when I moved to Chicago, I came here to do my CO work, which is in the accounting department. And when I finished my CO work, my dad was working for Shell Oil Company. And he worked doing some work for the personnel manager. And the personnel manager said, well, Shell's policy is they only hire college graduates. But he liked my dad well enough that he said, I'll give your son a job as a clerk. And I had a clerk there at Shell. And I moved up pretty fast. I mean, Washington, I was doing clerical work. I worked first in the just a clerk in the U.S. Coast Geodetic Survey, and I'm just a mailboy for the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, and then later became a computer operator for them. The old computers where they just type things on cards as they went through. I was working for Shell Oil for about a year, and I was not really happy with the job. I realized that, I thought earlier I might want to be an accountant. I was bored with his numbers. And I saw an ad in the local paper for an editor-writer. It was about a $5 decrease in salary, but it was $100 a week at Harvard. So I went over to him, Elmer Johnson in Brookfield, Brookfield Enterprise, and he hired me. And there I was in charge of writing the columns, planning the paper, writing articles, and doing the photography, not the actual photography. I was to frame and cut the pictures, crop them, and send them in for putting on zinc plates. I worked there for about a year and a half, and the biggest problem there was my paychecks were bouncing. He was having a problem. I keep getting money in the bank to pay the salary. You know, I like to get paid for my work, even if it was only $100 a week. So at the same time, there was a new area near us, Garfield Ridge, around Chicago's Midway Airport, that was opening up more and more into business, and they were starting to exhibit commerce. A new bank was moving down to the area on National Security Savings. And I met the banker, chamber meeting, recovery chamber with me. And John Wehner later ran for mayor of Chicago. He had his business in the area. And they both approached me that they would help finance a paper in the area if I would run it for them. And it was tempting. I talked to the brethren about it. I said, no, you'll be over your head. And your chance of success are very slight. And so I realized that. Finally, we had this organization meeting for the Chamber of Commerce. And I was put on the board for selecting the candidates for office. And the editor of the competing papers on the same board. And I liked him, Mr. Vodrak. I liked him very much. So one day I called him up. And I said, I'll make you a proposition. Garfield Ridge needs a paper. You start it, I'll run it. 20-year-old kid. I was about 23 at that time. He said, I'll get back to you. Well, my work at the first paper was late night work. Often I was there past midnight, getting the paper ready. got a call about 11 o'clock one night, and Mr. Mondrager said, why are you slaving away there when you can do work out here for good money? So I said, oh, I can't even talk about it. But maybe a proposition that wasn't very effective. So I paid $30 a week, plus commissions, anything you sell. And I'll guarantee you $90 a week. I was making $100 over there. But I was so disgusted over there, I took it. And I was no good at sales. I was too shy to be a salesman at the time. I could do the reporting. That was fine. I could do anything else, but sales I wasn't good at. So I wasn't getting much sales in. Well, then the sales manager from the other paper started the paper I wanted to start. And he started real low rates, real low advertising, way below his cost. And that got to my boss. My boss, this is war. He said, I'll match his costs. I'll still pay you the full commission. I'll subsidize you. But you got to sell. No more fighting for you. And he's on his feet all the time. So I'm in my first real cold turkey sales call. It was at a funeral parlor. And I said, you don't want to buy an ad, do you? And he said, come to think of it, I don't. But I learned. And there was a cross street from him was a grocery store. And I hit the grocery store at just the right time. And that grocery store put me over the top. This was my third month with Mondrag. Put me over the top. And within 6 months, I was a top salesman. And I stayed in the top for 31 years. I never was below the number one. So but when I left, they hired 3 salesmen to fill my territory. So most salesmen were covering about 30 ads a week. I was covering about 130. And that meant on Tuesday, when I delivered papers, I had over 100 stops to make on one day. It was running. But I had one experience that I learned from George Tabak that really helped me. As business increased, so did the time requirements increase. And I was spending 60 hours a week. I had a young family. You kids were small, so the family was young and how to raise you and keep the money coming in. But I didn't want to keep working 60 hours a week. So I decided I would try something very bold. I was making pretty good money by this time, selling. I picked up pretty good. I went to my boss and said, I don't want to work 5 days a week anymore. I want to work 4 days a week, but I will hire at my cost an assistant. I'll pay for it. I want an assistant. And then you're getting, instead of 40 hours or 60 hours with me working 60, you're getting 72 hours a week. You're getting more work. It's not costing any more. He said, well, I'll give you a counter proposal. He said, I'll accept that proposal, but I will not charge you just what you're paying him. I want 20% over that, that you pay me, to cover insurance costs and all the other costs that are involved. And desperately, I said, yes, I'll do it. And I was just like, where am I going to find a way to pay this guy? I said, I cut my salary about in half, you know, if I'm going to do this. And it wasn't a guy, it was Robin Hack. She was so good between us within a month. I still had as much as I made before, plus I was paying her. Then I hired Wayne Dawson. And Wayne was the type of at the time. Wayne and I had problems, you know. Wayne did things Wayne way, and he didn't correct Wayne's way of doing things. So many times I went out of the office ready to fire Wayne. But I just had too soft a heart. I never could fire anybody. And I said, well, even though we couldn't get along, he produced. And he increased business. And the best part was I hated collections. I got paid on collections, not on sales. I didn't collect, I didn't get paid. And he was good at collections. He would go in and say, my boss wants the money. I'll send it next week. I'll wait. You stand there. Do we have the money? So my work was in sales.
And I could ask, how did it happen that the worst sales and then you become the best? What did you do?
Basically the Lord, but also I got overcame my shyness. I had to. I had to support 2 kids. I didn't have a choice. I had to get out there, and one thing I've always been is competitive. I play games. You know, the kids growing up, we played checkers. I wasn't a good father. I didn't play to let them win. I played to beat them.
We never won anything.
Oh, your sister did. She can beat me at chess all the time. But back in 1961, I made a proposition to the boss. I wanted to buy a full-page ad in our paper, pay for it myself, to advertise the first volume. The 75th anniversary. Issue of the first volume. So he gave me a good price. And I bought the ad. And your sister, Becky Gray, was in the area at the time. We would do follow-up calls together. We got about 25 responses. But one of those was very interesting. The response said, I want the Divine Plan of the Ages only if it's original C.T. Russell. Do you have an Italian language? So Becky and I went to call on this Joe DiGenova. It was a Bible student. Brother Russell said. And lost contact with the Bible students. And no more. And he went to meetings when he died. He went to Italian meetings. We had Italian meetings at the time that Joe was old. Well, that's an area another I should cover on the tape is the meetings of Ruggiero's. That's an exciting part. When the Ruggiero family was first becoming Bible students, Tom was probably 7 or 8 years old. Joe a little older, Anna very young, and I'm not even sure John was born yet. But they're all very small. The original family spoke almost no English. The contact with them was a brother, Comparato, from Rochester, New York. And he was trying to come into Chicago and encourage somebody to have meetings with them. But nobody knew Italian. And Joy Kendall was saying, we have to do this. And she was trying to push it very hard. So she met with them personally, just in bad English, working back and forth. At the same time, there was a sister, Pesavento, who had a restaurant on the south side, and she was Italian, and she wanted an interest. And her daughter, Sister LaRoche, was also interested, and she had two daughters, Anita, now Osterman, and Michelle, and they were interested. So there was an interesting Italian community there. And then there's Giorgio DiGenova. And Giorgio DiGenova, I should mention this about him. When I first picked him up for the first meeting, I went down the Eisenhower Expressway, in the Lower Wacker. And I didn't slow down. I was pulled over by the police. Okay, where's your driver's license? I pulled it out. It expired 2 months before. Into the station. Got to write you up. You get one phone call. And then I'm embarrassed to pieces. The new interest I got in the car out there. So I leave him in the parking lot of the police station where I go in and get put in the brig. And I get my one phone call. I called Ron Proskin, who was going to the meeting. He said, Ron, I need to be bailed out of jail. $25 bail. And Ron said, I'll be right down. And he said, we could be almost there for the meeting. So Ron came down and he had $20 and I had $4. We then ended up for bail between us. So I scraped my change out of my pocket. He scraped the change out of his pocket. We had $1.01 in change. I had one penny left. He said, you take the penny. You need more than I do. So I went to the meeting. I was leaving the meeting that night. Brother Gene, you know, was, I don't know what happened at the police station, but I didn't want to tell him. I was too embarrassed. Then he went fine. We went overtime because we started late. Sister Pesavento always needed to go pick up her groceries, Italian groceries downtown at one store. So I said, I got you into this. I'll take you to the store. We got the store. They just closed. But the man was putting down the street. She runs after him, gets him back. He reopens the store. By this time, she missed her train. I'll take you home. Teacher Nova was in the car the whole time. So I go all the way home, drop her off. I'm empty of my gas gauge. I got no gas in the car. I got no money in my pocket. I got a stranger that I never met before. I'm trying to witness to. What a witness, you know. So, coming up, I did have a Shell credit card. I worked with Shell. Shell says we're closed tight on a drum. Standard was open. Everybody else was open. The Shell was closed. And then on the next station, I went to go in and try to beg mercy. And I saw a Shell station open. And I went, cough, cough, cough. And I go see it. And car stopped right at the pump. Drained totally. I got Billy DiGenova home finally about midnight. I got home. I said, what happened to you? I said, let me think of a better story up. You won't believe the truth. The thing I said I remember pretty well from the younger days was when Tom Hack and his age group were putting on a meal and a program for the kids, the younger kids. It was at our house in Lyons. And they were to cook the food and arrange their thing. And I go all the way. I remember, that's a good picture of Roger Zick there and Lee Wessel. And then afterwards, Donna Cook was here for some reason. I think I'm mixing two meetings up. Donna Cook was in one meeting. And Alfred Burns was at this different meeting. Alfred Burns was there. And Alfred Burns was telling the story by the Woodworth. And by this time, every girl in the class had a question on Alfred Burns. I mean, they all, Alfred Burns was it. If there were single, they had a question, including Donna. So anyway, Alfred was telling the story about the Woodworth. Now, when Brother Woodworth was really call partnering, He took out what is now Sister Woodworth. On the way back, he had a bad auto accident. And she was crippled and looked like she would not make it, that she would die. But she'd been in the hospital quite a while. And she would not accept any money from him to pay the hospital bills. So he said, there's only one solution. I'm going to marry her. Then she got to accept the money. So he married her. She got well. And she supported him the rest of his life. She was a doctor, and she supported him. So after the meeting, Donna Cliff stands in front of Oprah's car. I'm not with me, do you hit me? We finally worked it out that three of the deacons were always working together anyway, that we would take this on. Ron Proskin, George Tabak, and myself. And we would take turns leading this meeting. And what we would do is we worked through Tom Ruggiero. Tom was about 7, 8 years old at the time. We'd ask the question in English. Tom would translate the question in Italian. And then they'd jabber 10 minutes back and forth, and they'd argue with their hands flying. And then Tom would translate the sentences back to us. And then we'd either correct it or accept it and go on to the next paragraph. We went through the whole first line that way with Ruggiero. And I remember as we were coming in, of course, the strict elder in our class always was Edmund Jesuit. It was always, you know, a proverb that he did it Edmund's way, he did it the proper way, the strict way. Edmund was talking one Sunday, and Anna Ruggiero was probably about 6, 7. And Sarah had hard hearing, so she always sat near the front. And right in the middle of the meeting, Anna gets up and tugged at Edmund's coat. And Edmund didn't bend an eyelash. He had it so beautifully.
Anyway, what did he do?
He just let her tug. She finally went back. Not quite as good as when Edmund and Elder's meeting was upset with the sisters because they were starting to wear slacks to the meetings. He thought that was very improper. That was wearing men's clothing. And so in Elder's meeting, he brought up and said that he objected his sisters wearing slacks to the meetings. And Joe Miguel said, well, Edmund, do you want them to take them off?
Another thing that should go on the tape, too, is how you overcame stuttering.
I, as a child, was a total stutterer. I couldn't say a sentence without stuttering. A very, very bad stuttering problem. And when I went to the Dawn to work with my father in 1947, Sister Mary Norby was there. And she and Sister Irene Mitchell took me under their wing. I couldn't control my stuttering, and I couldn't control my hair. Irene took care of the hair. Every time I come down, I said, Carol, comb your hair. Carol, comb your hair. And Sister Norby would insist all summer long that I speak at this pace and no faster. I had to always answer her one word at a time and pronounce each word. And when I got back, I never stuttered seriously again.
So how many different language classes were in Chicago?
Well, of course, it was Polish, Lithuanian, Greek, English. I don't think those are German. I think that's pretty much all.
What was your involvement with the different classes?
I had very little involvement with them. I had some with the Lithuanian class. My brother there had wanted some of his money used to spread the truth, and he gave it to me to use. And when I didn't use it fast enough, he almost called for a church trial while I wasn't spending his money. But I was trying to find a better way to use it. The Lithuanian class, the elder lived on Lithia Street, and I knew him quite well. Remember the Zavost? He was here. I probably had more to do with the Lithuanian than most. Greek, I had very little. Brother Patterson, I got to know pretty well, and Brother Andy. But I didn't have a lot of communication. The Polish, I had a lot of communication later, but not before I started going to Poland. For a while, the Polish meetings were right next to our meetings at Chicago Avenue, and I didn't know that they knew me at all, but they did. I was the Gubi Brat. Fat brother. As the years went on, I became very close to the Polish class. In fact, I started speaking in their class in Polish for a while. Well, in what I call Polish, they call gibberish.
Also, can you tell more about the Cicero split that happened in the 40s, I think? I know that was before you were in Chicago.
I've gotten a new view on that now. I just read a paper I was given at the convention about the history of the Cicero class written by the Charlie Lukey. And it agrees mostly with what I've heard, although not totally. The Cicero class is an outgrowth of the Young Bible Studies movement. And also, the outgrowth of our class, as I understand it. In 1941, there was a big split in our class. The Herald speakers, although the Herald magazine was always straight in the truth, and the Herald elders of Chicago, whether Reed or the Hollister, were straight in the truth, the Herald had speakers who were not. And they were nominating the speaker of a general convention. I mean, the general convention began at the Herald convention. It began, Bill Siegman started the general convention. That's not the only known. In 1941, there was a business meeting to pass a motion that only Dawn speakers would be used in Chicago class. That motion was passed on a Sunday at the Grand Rapids Convention. Grand Rapids was a favorite convention for the Herald Brothers. They felt like it was planned to deny them the vote. They left the older ones to form the Herald class and the younger ones to form Cicero, as I understand. And Mother Luke indicates Cicero was formed a little earlier.
Why didn't they just go together as one class? Why did they just split with each other? There must have been some reason.
I think the younger ones wanted more direct Bible study. The younger ones were influenced a lot by an Italian brother, Brother Di Palma. He was a large influence on the early days of the Cicero class. There was more Italian influence than anything else there, even though I think Cicero was largely Polish in nature. But D'Alessandro's Italian. I know what Luki is. Sounds more Ukrainian to me.
Urbaniak the same.
Urbaniak is Polish. When I was in Washington, I began to consider my relationship to the Lord again. I realized that the consecration I had made and was immersed when I was 12 years old was not really a serious consecration. My heart meant well, but my head did not know what I was getting into. So now I began facing the reality of how do I make this right? Should I be reimmersed? Is that right or wrong? At the time I was going with Sister June Constant, and we would talk about it many times, and she was the one who largely influenced me to go to my heart. My heart said, you're more satisfied being immersed after you made a consecration. You should be reimmersed. And so I decided to make a second announcement of consecration to the brethren. I was reimmersed in 1954 at the Wilmington, Delaware Convention with Brother Henry Anderson doing the immersing. Following my talk, it was interesting that Brother Eugene Burns had the next talk, and Brother Eugene Burns likes to walk when he talks. And the immersion pool was right behind the speaker, and he was talking about Jonah. And just then he started tottering on the edge of the pool and almost fell in. Fortunately, he caught himself in time. Going back to the Al-Qaeda class. The little Al-Qaeda class had grown from two, my father and myself, to four, including my uncle Amos and Aunt Ruth, and then eight with Lloyd and Elizabeth and my dad and my mom and her stepbrother. And now we were going to have very good meetings. And now the idea was how to organize these meetings. What should they be? Two experiences I recall from that time. One was we decided to have a question meeting. And this question meeting would be open question meeting. And my first question that I asked was, what did it mean that Reuben would be unstable as water in Genesis 49? I recall many times the openness of these questions and the sincerity which we dug into the scriptures to find the answers. The other experience I remember from this time is my Uncle Lloyd, who was a more polished speaker than Amos or my dad, suggested we had discourses on a once a quarter basis. And my dad didn't know how to give a discourse. And he was in Chicago at a convention. We're talking to Brother Wylam. Brother Wylam had been our particular mentor all these years. And he asked Brother Wylam, how do you make a discourse? And Brother Wylam said, it's easy. You study, you shovel it in, and you let the Lord take it out. He said, it's that simple. He said, let the Lord be your spokesman. And I tried to use that myself, and I found it often has worked. I find the difficulty with giving ad lib discourses is sometimes you're not as organized as you should be. The benefit is you learn from your own talks. I many times found something I didn't know for myself in giving the talk. I've been able to add, oh, 2 + 2 is this, and 3 + 3 is this. And a new thought is there. It's a beautiful thought. So there's advantages to both.